Hello and welcome to the Australian Bitcoin Podcast. My name is Daniel Wazinski. This is Alex. Rogan Turns taking over the Bitcoin Podcast, bringing the news local and global for the month of March. With me this week is Pat. How you going, Pat?
I'm doing great, guys. It's good to be here. Very excited to be working with the Australian Bitcoin Podcast. Lots on the way from this channel. And my God, we've got a lot of news this month.
Yeah, it's another big, big month in Bitcoin. We're going to kick it off this month with some price action. We've got the big 100. We've crossed a big line. What do you think, Pat?
It's a big milestone. I thought this was going to be years and years away when I first got into Bitcoin. But here we are looking at the big six figures. And you can see this candlestick chart here. And you'd be right to think that the green means it progressed upwards and the red means there was a sell-off and the price declined. But it's called a candlestick chart because of the wicks. There is this extra candlestick wick. And that means the price reached that area, but did not stay there. So it's interesting in this chart in particular, if we move over and add these resistance lines here at each of these psychological points in the chart, you can see there was bouncing off 60,000, bouncing off 70,000, and it managed to break through. But once it's actually reached 100,000, it's been very strong, which is excellent to see.
It's exciting, but it's also boring. This is at the start of March, and now I'm already like, okay, come on, do something. But I think that's just how Bitcoin works.
Yeah, what's the next milestone? 250 or is it 200?
Yeah. Like, come on already. Yeah, it's pretty impressive. I'm sure there's a lot of parties going on. Also got the halving coming up, so I'm sure there's a lot of parties coming up for that as well. I've just seen that the halving party that's going on in El Salvador have just finished setting up. So a lot of people flying in for that. I know there's a whole bunch of local halving events that we'll talk about maybe at the end of the podcast that you can probably tee up if you're in a major city around Australia or even if you're in a more regional place with a Bitcoin meetup.
And for anybody who is a bit newer to Bitcoin tuning in, you just have to zoom out. 100,000 seems like it's going to stop, doesn't it? But you just have to zoom out and you'll see that it climbs and climbs and climbs. This is not a stop along the way. It is just a little milestone. We're trucking along. We're powering through.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It's a stay humble, stack sats. We're celebrating, you know, a number. There's 100,000.
A fiat number.
But a fiat number, yeah. But it really has no bearing on actual Bitcoin's fundamentals. Some other exciting price-related news is, I guess, with this recent pump, Bitcoin's now the fifth largest base money. So the US dollar is in first, then the euro, the Chinese yuan, and Japanese yen. And then Bitcoin. Bitcoin's fifth largest base money, which is kind of crazy to think about. And the little Australian dollar is now trailing all the way behind in ninth place. So Bitcoin is, you know, leaving the oceanic peso, as Checkmatey likes to call it, far, far behind. All right, moving on to some Australian news to get us started. We just had Bitcoin Alive. So Bitcoin Alive is Australia's Bitcoin-only conference. It's on in Sydney. It was on at the end of the month in March. Really awesome to see. Really enjoyed it. I mean, it's just a great event for all of the community to get together. Pat was there as well. What did you think of the event?
It was so professional. I was really impressed. I didn't know what to expect when I turned up, but it was a full deal. I mean, it was really well run.
Yeah, everything just, I mean, I went last year and I think I've told you before, but even last year, it was really well run and they only had like 4 months when they decided to put it on and everything just ran exactly to schedule. Seemed like miraculously a whole bunch of things that could have gone wrong, did not go wrong. And so this year I came in with big expectations and yeah, they blew it out of the park again. Like the speakers were all excellent. Obviously the merch stand was excellent because I helped to man that for a lot of the day. Yeah, it was just great. Great to see the whole community just like saying hi and catching up with friends the whole time.
There was some serious international talent there as well. It wasn't just Australians. There was Eric Kayson who, did you catch Eric Kayson? He went nuts. It was a delight.
Yeah.
He was going off.
Yeah, the man can rant. Yeah.
Danny Knowles was a great interviewer, on point as always. People may have heard of Tip NZ, who did a live performance.
That was really powerful, actually.
And a big shout out to everybody who traveled from Perth.
Absolutely. On to some more Australian news. Craig Wright is not Satoshi. Surprise. Nobody here knew that or has known that for years and years and years. But we've got the final court judgment. The UK court has passed down a written judgment that Craig is absolutely 100% not Satoshi. More than that, in the last couple of days, they've issued a worldwide freeze on his assets for up to £6 million. I'm sure there's a lot of relief from, you know, the people that were subject to some vexatious litigation, especially core devs. In fact, there are a couple of core devs that have said that they may consider coming back to working on Bitcoin Core. They'd previously abandoned working on Bitcoin Core, at least in public, just because it was attracting this unwanted attention, which was really getting in the way of their work. And so Vladimir, who's one of the previous Bitcoin Core maintainers and really kind of like almost like a bit of a leader in the project, announced that he might be coming back. Did you see the journalists getting around at Bitcoin Alive? We had a visit from ABC's 730 report as well as the Australian Financial Review, and they thought it was big news that Craig Wright has been deemed not to be Satoshi. Did you have a chance to see those guys kicking around?
I didn't see them down there, but I did catch their report, and it was quite interesting to see what got through and what didn't get through. But they have, of course, tailored it to their audience. You can go find that on YouTube under the 730 report covering the Craig Wright trial.
Yeah, it was good. I mean, the point of Bitcoin Alive in my eyes is, well, it's firstly, it's to put on a great conference that we can all enjoy. Well, I mean, that's why people attend. They attend because it's enjoyable, because they get a lot out of it. But another key focus for Bitcoin Alive has just been that public-facing entity to represent the Bitcoin-only view to the public, to the mainstream media. That's a sort of a point of contact. And so it is great to see the media come down and take this seriously, listen to some of our more notable coherent voices, like Chris, who is one of the organizers, like Checkmate, like Lloyd and Nick, who also I saw getting interviewed, probably a handful of others. And yeah, the outcome was great. We had a couple of good sound bites. I know Chris said something along the lines of the whole reason that he's so emotional about Bitcoin is that Bitcoin is like a rule book that everyone can read. It's about a rules-based order where the rules are like a level playing field for everyone. I don't want to overestimate it, but I think it's significant when we can even just get these like little sound bites into the public consciousness, especially in the lead up to a bull run where, you know, they're going to be potentially distracted by a whole range of other crypto or shitcoiners in their schemes.
Yeah, it's just fantastic to see them there at the second event they ever put on. Still quite a lesser known event, quite a small event, and there's a lot of hope that they'll be back next year, potentially giving even more coverage.
Looking forward to it.
We have more Australian news for you this month. The Australian Digital ID Bill was passed recently. Hasn't been too many specific breakdowns of the contents, but the overall idea is to centralize personal info so that there is one big government data honeypot, which is secured. And we all know how well the government does at securing data. So the Australian Senate has a national digital identity scheme that they are pushing forward. This is well known, well established. They essentially want to give everybody their own digital ID, which will replace the need for handing over your driver's license, your passport, things like this. They are citing that people have to repeatedly present their physical documents and gather them up from their filing cabinets and who knows where else they're keeping it, and present them just to, I don't know, rent a house. So there has been some pushback on all of this. People are worried about their data privacy, of course. And the Greens actually made some amendments which won the support of the Senate, ensuring that the scheme will remain truly voluntary and that paper documents must still be accepted to verify identities of individuals who still wish to use them. So it's not as bad as it may seem, but they are certainly pushing toward the digital identification side of things. There's an expectation that the banks and the real estate agents will be mostly on board, but it is anticipated to become the norm in the wider Australian economy, despite all these claims that it won't be mandatory.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's just the obvious trend, right? It's just like cash, you know, like anyone can, you know, we're still making cash available, and then they just start paring down all the ATMs. It's like, oh, well, we don't accept cash here. And it's just an inevitable trend like that. I think it'll be the same progression with digital ID. There's not a lot we can do about it. We can push back in a legal sense, but it's just, it seems like an inevitable march. And for us, it's probably better for us to focus on Bitcoin, those of us that know about Bitcoin, and leave the fight against digital ID to the people who maybe are passionate about these libertarian issues, passionate about freedom, but maybe haven't yet found Bitcoin yet. don't know. Does that sound reasonable to you? I think we should be in the fight. Maybe we should be in the fight. Maybe I'm completely wrong.
Perhaps we need to make our voices heard when they try to make it mandatory. National Digital ID scheme is something that's not going to go away anytime soon. We'll just have to keep our eye on it for now.
Twitter is going to be running, or X under Elon Musk, they're going to be running a case against Australia's eSafety Commissioner. So for those that aren't aware, we have an eSafety Commissar who is responsible for censoring speech online, or, you know, keeping us all safe, in other words. And so essentially, this is a fairly new role that has got established within the last couple of years. Julie Inman Grant has launched an enforcement action for a takedown of some material that deemed unsafe for Australians to view. And Twitter has been at the threat of fines of something like $800,000 a day that they don't take down, to which they've currently complied. But the interesting news is that Elon Musk, at the head of X or Twitter, has announced that he's going to be running a court case pushing back on that. And so it's quite notable because the eSafety Commissioner is sort of a fairly new role within Australia. It's only been the last couple of years, and this is the first serious challenge. So this has only just been announced, so we'll see how this develops. But it's certainly an important thing to know, and we'll follow up as it develops.
Did you really say 800,000 a day?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty crazy. Yeah. So they have very strong legislative powers to control and censor online speech. I actually messaged one of my close friends the other day. It's like, did you know we have a free speech commissar? And no. Most people will probably have zero awareness of, or maybe they've peripherally heard of, you know, the fact that we have an e-safety commissioner, but they probably don't understand that their role is literally to censor and moderate online speech. So quite significant. And so it'll be interesting to see how this sort of first attempt at pushing back goes through our legal system. We'll let you know how it progresses.
And speaking of the legal system, the Australian court dismissed the lawsuit by the market regulator against Finder in a landmark ruling for the crypto industry. So the Australian court ruled in favor of Finder Wallet against the market regulator, the Australian government.
Yeah, so Finder was running what they called their earn product, and the Australian government had alleged that they didn't have the necessary licensing, but they've lost the case. Specifically, the case was about whether the product was a type of investment or not. In Australia, we have the Australian Financial Service Licensing Scheme, and anything that's seen as like an investment product requires licensing. But this case is seen as a pretty significant win for the crypto industry, because it's resulted in the definition of a crypto asset as a financial product. So things like the Finder's own product will probably require licensing into the future, and we'll see more regulation coming around that. Along with that, we'll probably be seeing the regulation around crypto asset providers, which is something that will affect us here at Higherblock, to be drafted by the end of this year. And then they're probably looking to have a sort of a 12-month ramp up, where exchanges have about 12 months to transition to the new regime. So definitely interesting to keep our eyes on this legislation. We spoke to a crypto lawyer just incidentally a few months ago, and their opinion was that we're probably unlikely to actually see this rollout occur on time, just because it might not necessarily be the highest priority. And also there's just a whole degree of complexity, which is probably being underestimated by the government at the moment in terms of how they're going to roll this out. But it'd be interesting to see. All right, onto our last Australian article for this month. Australian WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange was granted the right to fight his extradition to the US. Right now, he's waiting on a decision. So the court is currently seeking assurances for safety from the US government. It was initially set for April the 16th, but it's been extended, the pushback to their final decision, to May the 20th now, after which a second hearing will be held to consider whether to grant him an appeal or not. So remembering that this is the same US government that it was revealed plotted to assassinate him, maybe we don't give a lot of credence to those assurances, but we'll see if the court is satisfied with them or not come May 20th. Julian's brother, Gabriel Shipton, was one of our speakers at Bitcoin Alive, talking to us about the campaign fighting for Julian's freedom. And he really summed it up in a recent tweet, which was, you wouldn't leave your kids with a meth head no matter what assurances they gave you. And yeah, I think that really does sum it up. The British prison system hasn't allowed him access to lawyers to prepare his case, which is very unusual. And then his case is further complicated because he's charged with unauthorized possession and dissemination of classified information, which is, you know, something that the mainstream media has been doing for years without facing any charges.
Over in the EU, there is a bill being put forward to the government to prevent money laundering. However, they are trying to sneak in some anti-crypto laws along with this. The sweeping AML package eliminates anonymous cash payments over 3,000 euros, which is around 5,000 Australian dollars, in commercial transactions, and prohibits cash payments above 10,000 euros, 16,500 Australian, in any business transactions. So people in Europe are fighting back. They don't want to lose their ability to use cash, and there's a battle taking place for personal financial freedoms. Along with these AML laws is a requirement for KYC checks on all Bitcoin payments to custodial wallets. The law would require crypto service providers to comply with extended customer verification requirements, as well as monitor cross-border transfers and payments involving private wallets. These changes will affect the wider market beyond Bitcoin, and apparently a significantly impacted sector is online casinos, who use Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, there is no second best, to transact. But there are non-KYC casinos that exist, so I'm not sure how effective any of this will be on that. It's important to note that the prohibition apparently does not apply to providers of hardware and software wallets or self-hosted wallets because they do not possess access to or control over these wallets. So how can they enforce that? The final vote is set to take place on April 22nd. And let's hope that the voices of those in the EU are loud enough. Moving over to the US, there was a Bitcoin flash crash down to $8,900 on BitMEX. The price on BitMEX, just the one exchange, crashed down due to large sell orders worth over $55 million US. And the price was very far from $67,400, the global average at the time. But the flash crash was very short-lived and it recovered back to $67,000 within minutes. Apparently, BitMEX is looking into a few suspicious accounts. And despite the crash, everything on BitMEX continued to work totally fine. The platform confirmed that all the systems were normal, all funds were safe. So it's great to see another glitch in the wild that doesn't really affect Bitcoin at all.
More news from the US. Sam Bankman-Fried has been sent to prison for 25 years. And as well as this, we've got more legislation. The US TikTok ban bill has passed the House in the US, 352 votes to 65 votes, and now goes to the Senate. So what is this bill? So it's a bill that is attempting to lead to a US-wide ban of TikTok if it isn't sold by its Chinese-based owner. So the bill makes it unlawful for an entity to distribute, maintain, or update a foreign adversary-controlled application by providing services to such a foreign adversary-controlled application or providing internet hosting services. So in essence, this is really just a pathway for the US government to declare that any given company is a national security threat, any foreign-owned company, and then coercively force the file sale of their assets. Now, it's bad enough, but really the way to view this is a lens to use almost as a threat. So we're not necessarily expecting fire sales of mass foreign-owned companies. It's much more that it's going to be used as a threat and ensure compliance with censorship and restricting speech, especially in platforms such as TikTok. And it's a pretty extreme increase in the legal power for the US government to do these things.
That's right. They don't have to go ahead and actually tell them to shut down, sell everything. They're not going to go that far. Everybody will toe the line now. And it's another power play by the US government. Over to other governments. El Salvador has made their Bitcoin holdings and address public. You can go see that for yourself. They're currently holding almost 6,000 Bitcoin, just over $400 million. El Salvador has also acted on its criticism about KYC laws in the country. that were stifling innovation for Bitcoin startups there. So they've lifted the KYC limits from $200 to $25,000, and the reforms are already approved in Congress.
Yeah, that's great to see. Really, really quick for them to act on that. It was only a couple of weeks ago that there was, I guess, sort of a bit of outrage on Twitter about their extremely limiting and restrictive KYC laws. So they pushed that through Congress of El Salvador extremely quickly and addressed criticisms from Bitcoiners. So it's great to see. And just in general, the transparency is very much appreciated. Back to the US, and MicroStrategy now owns more than 1% of the total Bitcoin supply. And it's continuing to convert any premium on the stock into Bitcoin with convertible note offerings. So doubling down and doubling down again. If you're looking at the share price of Master for any reason, MicroStrategy, Master's their ticker, it's just been going absolutely crazy in recent weeks. And it's been up nearly 350% since the start of February. So vastly outpacing Bitcoin. Meanwhile, Michael Saylor just urges you to ignore Master and just simply buy and hold Bitcoin. And he's maintaining that the MicroStrategy is purely for sophisticated investors who are otherwise unable to get Bitcoin exposure. So it's really just, it's a vehicle for people that are restricted from buying and holding Bitcoin themselves.
I think there's also quite a number of people who have a much easier time paying tax on their stocks and things like that. So they can opt for a company that has such crazy exposure to Bitcoin that it's outpacing Bitcoin. And when it comes time to sell, they don't have to worry too much about the legality of what they're doing.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, that makes sense. I think having more established assets rather than Bitcoin allows you to do other things as well. Like it's more available to use for lending purposes, those kinds of things, as margin, collateral. Until those sort of Bitcoin ecosystems get built out, then potentially there's still an argument to be made in that side as well. But I think for the average Bitcoiner, it's very much just a case of buy a whole Bitcoin yourself. But wow, it's interesting to watch, that's for sure.
And in a shocking comparison, actually, the BlackRock ETF has accumulated 1% of the total supply as well. But just in the past 2 months, I mean, pretty scary sign of what's to come, isn't it?
Yeah. There's some real demand out there, that's for sure.
The supply shock that's coming is going to be absolutely crazy. Moving over to Canada, people purchasing Bitcoin via Canada Post now must verify their identity before using Bull Bitcoin services to purchase Bitcoin. This was mandated by Canada Post as a condition to continue their service. However, there is a positive side to the story. We have to realize that they are still allowing the purchase of Bitcoin. They just want their share of the tax.
So I think I was asking this just before. So this means that prior to this, it was possible to acquire KYC-free Bitcoin in Canada quite easily. It's quite interesting, isn't it? Is that right?
Thank you, Bull Bitcoin. Yeah, I don't know too much about their service, but that seems to be the case. So starting April 15th, it's no longer possible. Get in there while you can.
A few more days. Some news from Europe, and Roman Sterlingov was been found guilty on 4 counts, with the court finding chain analysis to be reliable. For those that aren't aware, Roman Sterlingov is I guess, someone who's been alleged to have been running Bitcoin Fog, which is a Bitcoin mixing service, which was associated and tied in with money laundering from illegal activities over in Europe. Roman is said as part of the case that he's admitted to having been a user of Bitcoin Fog, which is not illegal, but has claimed that he was not running the service. And what's interesting about this case, and if you've heard about the case before, why you've probably heard about it, is that there's no clear evidence to suggest that he was running the Bitcoin Fog mixer. And the entire case rests on probabilistic analysis provided by Chainalysis. And so Chainalysis is one of these on-chain surveillance firms. They look at the on-chain data, and then they suck up as much data from outside of the on-chain as well. And then they try and match it up to try and conduct this sort of mass surveillance. And then they use this probabilistic analysis where, for example, if you're making a payment on the Bitcoin main chain, it's very common that the payment you make will be a round number, whereas the change, for example, will be whatever the difference is. So one of the heuristics that Chainalysis might use, for example, is they might say that, okay, well, that Bitcoin has gone to someone else, that's a round number, and the Bitcoin that is a like a jumbled up, complex, random looking number, that's most likely still held by that original person. And so they use these kind of heuristics to try and probabilistically figure out who's owning Bitcoin, who's moving around, who's transacting with who. And what's interesting about this case is that this Chainalysis software has been used sort of like the key evidence, supposedly claiming that Roman was running Bitcoin Fog. And the problem is that all of this software is probabilistic. It's based off heuristics. It's not absolutely certain. It's possible, but it's far from certain. It's a really dangerous precedent, because what we have now is we have this black box with the software, the Chainalysis software, that the courts are treating as evidence and accepting. And there's no way to challenge this black box if it pronounces that you're guilty and that, you know, your transactions meet up here. And so the defense claimed and wanted to investigate the software and look into it. They even had Brian Bishop, who is like one of the sort of very notable Bitcoin Core developers, made himself available to look at the evidence and assess it and provide an independent opinion. And that was denied. So the defense was prevented from examining on the grounds that it was Chainalysis's proprietary software. And if they revealed their magic source, then that would potentially prevent them from competing in the market in the future. And so, yes, yeah, very, very dangerous precedent that's been set with this verdict. And of course, as you'd expect, Roman's defense is planning to appeal the guilty verdict. It's even more complex than it first sounds, because there's a whole range of, if you care, I encourage you to look up the case. There's a few great podcasts that have been done with Roman's two lawyers, and they explain sort of like the mass conflicts of interest that are taking place. You know, we've got people rotating out of the prosecutors and like as investigators, and then working for Chainalysis and then rotating back. So it's a huge mess of a case, but it's a very dangerous precedent that they're setting. Yeah. So we'll see how it goes. Awesome. On to some technical news. Hardblock celebrating its 10th birthday. So unfortunately Dan's not here to celebrate with us today, but yeah, Dan built the first instance of the exchange back in 2014. It's become one of Australia's preferred Bitcoin-only exchanges. So yeah, just congratulations to Dan and the rest of the team that have been working hard over all those years.
Happy birthday.
Yeah.
In other technical news, there has been a lot of software updates. There's been updates for Sparrow, which is the desktop wallet of choice by the vast majority. Gives great insights to people who are newer to the space. It gives a lot of extra information, helps you learn while you're doing things. It's very secure, of course. I believe it's open source as well. Lots of updates coming out all the time for Sparrow. Cold Card Q, you may have heard of the Cold Card, the hardware wallet. Cold Card Q is an upgraded version, bigger screen, bit more power, some other improvements, and they're bringing out their software updates to continue to improve their product, as well as Electrum, another one getting a lot of updates. It's a very popular Bitcoin wallet, and it has a connection to your Bitcoin full node. You may have come across the Electrum server. They are continuing to improve their product as well. Not only that, the Bitcoin development kit has officially hit version 1, which is a programmer's toolkit, very important in the space. And there's a joke in software development that you should never leave beta, because everybody is way more forgiving of all your project's issues. So the Bitcoin Development Kit has announced their first official release with version 1.0.0 alpha, which is just great.
Yeah, it's been a big effort from what I understand with BDK, their rewrite. They took things in a quite significant change of direction with their 1.0 and a lot of updates and added functionality. So shout out to Lloyd Fournier from Bitcoin Sydney, who's one of our sort of prolific developers. He's really heavily involved with working on Bitcoin Dev Kit. So congrats. Some more hardware wallet news. So along with the launch of the Cold Card Q, which is, I mean, to be fair, it's quite similar to the Cold Card. It's just with a few extra enhancements, like a full-size keyboard. We've also had the launch of the BitKey and the Portal wallet. So BitKey is a product by Block, which is, you've probably heard of Block. If you don't know, then they're the parent company of companies like Square and Cash App, Spiral, Tidal, and TBD. And yeah, essentially, they've gone for a very interesting model. I think Pat was going to walk us through this one.
So the BitKey is a hardware wallet. You may be familiar with just the 24 words. Hopefully, it's 24. 24-word seed phrase. This is a signal signature wallet where the seed phrase creates your private key. And that's what's most important, generates all of your addresses and things like that. And this is different to multiple seeds creating one wallet. And with multi-signature, you need a certain number of keys. Maybe you have three seeds, three devices, or three different seed signers. And perhaps you only need two of those to move your funds and to access your wallet. And there's a lot of trade-offs. There's a lot of benefits. And people are a bit scared of multi-signature, I think, because of its complexity. People are happy with their single seed phrase, but things like the BitKey are making strides to improving the user experience with things like this.
Yeah, for sure. I think multi-sig as it stands now, it's not impossibly difficult. It's definitely possible to do by yourself if you take the time and you build up to it. But there are a couple of small mistakes you can make that are not necessarily intuitive that can bring you completely undone. And one of those big mistakes that people can make with multi-sig is around the XPubs, which is that you need to have all XPubs for all the keys to recover the wallet. So if you don't know what that means, then that's fine. Just be careful. Maybe it's not time to step into multi-sig just yet, and maybe it's time to do a bit of research before you do that. That's all. The interesting thing about BitKey's setup is that they've gone for a 2 of 3 model where they've got one key held in your phone on a hot wallet, one key is being held in the hardware device, the BitKey itself, and then one key that there is being going to be held by Block themselves in a server type setup. What's interesting about that is that the purpose of the BitKey in the 2 of 3 is really just as a recovery. So you still control the funds because you've got the 2 of 3. You control 2 of the 3 seeds, but the expectation is that generally you would sign with your phone and reaching out to the server. And so what that allows them to do is it allows them to have interesting spending policies, things like time blocks and daily spend limits, even vaults, these kind of setups, which are enforced at the key holder level. So if you want to make a payment, you can set up a signing policy with Block or through the app, and they will only sign it with their server key if it meets those policy requirements. So say you want to only allow your wallet to spend $1,000 worth of Bitcoin in a day, then their server will check what's happened so far and it will refuse to sign if it exceeds that limit. But you're still in control because you've got the hardware wallet, the BitKey. And so if you ever wanted to, you could overrule that. But the idea would be that you would keep the BitKey in maybe a secure separate location. And so you get all the advantages of these spending policies, which currently aren't able to be done purely on chain, and they get enforced at sort of a signatory level. It's quite interesting. The other interesting thing about the BitKey is that they've opted not to have a screen on the hardware device itself, which is, they've come under a bit of criticism for this, but I think the model I've gone for is really about easy UX and having like an extremely smooth onboarding process. So it's maybe not the wallet that is designed for your super hardcore Bitcoiner with large amounts that really wants to trustlessly and independently verify every step of the way. It's much more thinking from the other side of the page where you've got maybe someone who's on an exchange, has their funds on exchange, or maybe someone who's currently using single sig and it hasn't really been comfortable with making the leap to multi-sig, but they want that dispersal, the extra security that comes from having separate keys. And I think from that perspective, if you're not someone who, like, you're happy with a small amount of trust in your setup, I think it looks like it's going to be an excellent option. And I've seen some great reviews from both online and from a handful of people we know from the Australian Bitcoin community have got their hands on one, that it's, yeah, a very, very slick and smooth user experience. The other hardware wallet is the Portal, which has just been announced by Alikos Fellini, who's a prominent developer known for his work on the Bitcoin Dev Kit. It's a mobile-first hardware wallet powered entirely through NFC. It's a pretty novel design. It's definitely not quite as portable as other hardware wallets we've seen, definitely not as much as the BitKey. And it's quite large so that it can be completely powered by NFC through your phone. So the design, maybe it's easier to look up and see a picture, but for those listening, it's kind of imagine a large circle, which is the NFC receiver, I guess, transmitter, and that powers the entire device, and then a screen on the side. So the idea would be that you put it up behind your phone, and then the screen would poke out on the right or left-hand side, and you'd be able to read it. The other interesting thing about the wallet is that they've completely open-sourced all of their custom hardware designs, including their chip, which they've got a custom-designed chip, which is pretty impressive that they've gone to that level of making everything open-source and independently verifiable. It's definitely on the more hardcore end of the spectrum. It's geared towards those Bitcoiners that really want to be able to independently and trustlessly sort of verify. I mean, that's what the screen is for. That's what all the open sourcing is about. So really interesting to see how the uptake on that style of wallet is as well. It is definitely quite bulky, but yeah, it's interesting, novel, new design. So we'll see what the market thinks.
I just want to say, I think it's fantastic that all of these new wallets coming out, all of these different software projects, they're all going open source. It is so good to see that it's becoming the mainstream. It's becoming the norm. Quite frankly, how could you go back after this? Everybody should be looking for open source stuff.
Yeah. It needs to be open source. If it's not open source, then you really are placing a lot of trust in the manufacturer and the producer. So at the minimum, you should be expecting that your software is open source and it's getting external reviews. The open source hardware is, that's impressive. I don't know if we've got other manufacturers doing that at the moment. I mean, maybe SeedSigner, I guess.
Things like CoinKite are open source. That's the cold card. However, they do have the secure element, which is by design not meant to be open source. They can't give away all the secrets of that. That's all of the technical news for this month. In other news, you may be wondering why we haven't touched on the halving. And that's because we are waiting for Daniel's special episode coming early next week, teaching all beginners and the non-technical about the halving. It's going to be great. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, well, I'm definitely looking forward to the halving as well. Fortunately, my node has just run out of space, so it's just fallen over. But I've hurriedly ordered a new 2 terabyte SSD, so I'm hoping that arrives in time to get it back up and running. I want to see that block on my own node and see that halving block come in. At the start of the episode, we mentioned that there's likely to be a whole bunch of halving events. I know that there's a halving party being put on by the Victorian Bitcoin Technology Club, which has just been newly established down in Melbourne. There's also another halving event happening up around Byron Bay with the Northern Rivers crew. In Sydney, we're planning to go out for a dinner at the Bitcoin Sydney meetup. I'm sure there's something happening in Brisbane, in Adelaide, and at all the other meetups. So if you're keen to meet some Bitcoiners, search out your local meetup and get involved in the community. That's all for this week. So thanks, everyone. Hope you enjoyed it. Leave feedback in the comments or reach out to us if you want us to talk about something specific or shout outs. Thanks, Pat, and see you next time.
Thanks for having me. Lots more news to come next month, no doubt. Thanks, everybody.
See ya.